started playing at what, about age 9? Is that when you started playing drums?
I actually got a toy kit when I was 4, and I kind of blew out all the heads the first day. And so basically, yeah, I mean, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, I started, you know, doing these once a week out of class to go to the auditorium to get drum lessons. It was this thing they had when I was a kid in elementary school. And then, of course, junior high and high school, I joined the marching bands with the big hats and all that stuff. And it was interesting. I've been playing for a long, long time. I used to, you know, back then there was no YouTube with a million people showing you how to do certain timing.
Right.
So, like the needle on the turntable.
Mm-hmm.
For the young people who don't know what a turntable is. Yeah. That's how we used to, you know, learn the stuff, you know, pick up the needle, go back, and was that fill or slow it down, you know?
Yep. I did the same thing with bass, though, not drums, but.
Okay. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. But you had credit your mom for influencing you on sticking with the drums. What happened there? Were you gonna quit?
Drums in high school with her sister who played piano, and then my uncle, he played trombone. They had like a little jazz quartet in high school, and back then for females to play drums wasn't very common. So she used to get, teased a lot, but she was the first one, she was, you know, had Beatle records and stuff. And actually she gave me all her Beatle records after John Lennon made the comment about they were just as popular as Jesus Christ. And she goes, I don't want these albums. It's funny that she gave them to me. She didn't just throw them away. But yeah, it was weird. That's pretty much how I got introduced to the Beatles, was my mom giving me these records. And then, of course, I went and saw that movie Help like about 58 times, like every Saturday with my neighbor, because I wanted to be just like Ringo Starr. You know, I was just totally into the Beatles back then, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What else were you listening to growing up?
Back, you know, when I was real young, there was the AM radio and was all the Wrecking Crew songs. You know, all the radio hits, you know, they all sounded alike to me. And I didn't realize they were all the same players playing in these various groups and artists. But I listened to a lot of that. But the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Santana, Free, Grand Funk, Jimi Hendrix, stuff like that. The Who, Cream. That's basically the bands
ones. Okay. And then you started your first band at age 13. Is that correct?
I was 13. It was called Hog Bottom, I believe. The first actual band. It was a 3-piece.
Was that a cover band, or did you guys do originals?
No, we did covers.
Okay.
You know, one of the guys, the guitar player, his name is Joe Delgado. He's in a band called the Delgado Brothers. They've been around ever since then. They do blues and stuff. And he was the guitar player. And then my other guitar player, Tom Gray, who passed away a few years from cancer, he played bass in that arrangement at the time. And I remember we were learning Mississippi Queen, and Joe's older brother comes in and he goes, "Hey, I think that song's a little bit too heavy for you guys." You know, we were just little 13-year-olds trying to, you know, do all these tunes that we liked, you know, so it was fun, yeah.
Right. And then when did you start getting into, like, the club scene and stuff?
Well, I did a lot of backyard party band stuff. You know, we were in this band. We do clubs. We'd have to learn, like, you know, a bunch of cover tunes, top 40 stuff to get, you know, any work actual getting paid for. But we did a lot of backyard parties. But I'd say, I don't know, in probably my late 20s, we were doing clubs, local clubs and stuff. Not a lot, though. I mean, I just really wasn't into learning a whole bunch of cover songs. And even to this day, it's like, you know,
Do a
project and stuff. It's fun. But, you know, I'm pretty consumed with what I do now. But maybe someday I'll do a side project of some sort. But... the club scene was cool. I mean, you know, you know, you learned a lot because you had to play all these different types of bands, you know, that you normally wouldn't buy or even listen to, and then let alone learn it. So it kind of broadens your spectrum of music you're listening to or working on or doing.
Sure. Now, growing up in the LA area, because you were born out there and pretty much lived out there your whole life, right?
Yes, I was Los Angeles.
Tell me about being a kid growing up in that environment, because when you were getting into like heavily into the drums and getting ready to, you know, really try and do something with drums, that's when the scene was picking up, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, when I first got in Great White, I was 30. So, right.
Now that's a little older than like somebody normally getting into a band, getting signed and going.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of glad that it did take that long for me, because if I would have gotten that kind of an opportunity when I was way younger, I probably would have blown it. Mm. You know, just not mature enough. I wouldn't have the right mindset or, you know, appreciation of what it took to get there. You know, when something gets handed to you when you're really young, man, you got to really have a good head on your shoulders, or bad things could happen. I'm not saying.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work to be a successful band.
A lot of work and a lot of luck too, for sure. Being at the right place at the right time. You know, releasing like when we did the Once Bitten, Twice Shy single. You know, my manager, he played that song in the car one time going to lunch, and he turns back and looks at us in the backseat. He goes, "You guys could really rip this song up." And I'm thinking, I hate this song. I didn't really like it to begin with, you know. And I was a big Mata Hoopa fan and everything, but I just never liked that song. And so, you know, we redid it. And who knew? I didn't know it was going to be selling 100,000 copies a week and you know, saw 3 million, you know, albums. And the single alone went gold, which was amazing at that time, because singles, you know, they weren't really playing at that time, you know. Mm-hmm.
And you came into the band in 84, right, with Shot in the Dark album?
Yes, 84.
And that was, you recorded that album, correct?
Yes, I'm on every, except for that very first one, the black one.
Yeah.
Night on Your Knees and Street Killer.
I have this one. I don't know if you didn't do this one though, right? This is like something else.
That's something. What is that? Like an EP? I've seen that. I've signed a bunch of those before.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've seen that. I have a lot of other discs like that are really rare. Uh-huh. Yeah. Or limited print, or for, you know, just for the industry.
Yeah, yeah. So was Shot in the Dark, was that your first major recording session?
That was my first actual LP. Actually, when I auditioned for Great White, I had known Jack. Jack was in the band with me when he was 16. We were called Centaur. And Mark Kendall was in a band called Zizzix. And we used to be rival bands playing backyards and stuff. So, I just lost my train of thought why I was even going to tell you this. What would you just ask me right now?
About your recording, Shot in the Dark, if that was your first time recording.
I auditioned several times for Great White, and one of the part of the auditions was actually recording a song that we had, you know, wrote as a band a couple of days prior. So I went in for the final audition, was actually playing in the studio with the band, with the engineer, with the producer, with the manager, all standing behind the glass watching me play. And I've never been to a click track before. And that was kind of intimidating at first. And just having everybody sitting there looking through, you know, by yourself in this room playing the song. And everybody's talking about you're playing it, you know. That was pretty cool. And then, you know, like I said, doing the first Shot in the Dark album, the actual first LP I did, that was a really cool experience for me, you know, as far as recording goes. And now I've done what, 16 some odd albums since then. So you learn some time.
What, tell me about the audition. So you had a record that was part of it?
Yeah, I did like 4 or 5 rehearsal auditions with these guys just working on stuff. And they kept trying other drummers out. And then they called me back to record. They wanted to see if I could actually record a song in the studio. You know, it's if I can cut it, so to speak. So we worked on a song that they wrote, and you know, I had all my own drum parts to it and everything. And Mark came and picked me up from the rehearsal room and took me to the studio, and I set up my stuff, and we recorded the song. And it was a lot of pressure, you know, because it was part of the audition, and but you know, I made it, and that was quite a learning experience for sure, you know, under pressure, people looking at you through the glass.
Oh, it's awful! I can't imagine. What do you remember? What song it was? Was it the song that you guys play?
For that audition, the demo. It never surfaced on any record. I couldn't even tell you what the name of it was.
Okay. So, yeah. Shot in the Dark was their second record, Great White, right?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, yeah. And did they do touring off that like heavily, or
when we did that record, we were just playing local clubs that I had played in frequently with other bands, you know, like the Whiskey, the Troubadour, the Country Club, just various places, Cornhuskers, Timbers. I'm just all over the place, Orange County, San Gabriel Valley. We played all these places. I played in for, you know, like 20 people, and every place we played was completely sold out.
Hmm.
And I went, wow, these guys are pretty popular. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was on a major label, wasn't it?
It was on EMI.
Okay.
EMI. And the funny thing is, when I got in the band, we were planning on making another record, and the record company decided to drop us. They got a new president, new everybody in there, and they knew nothing in history about the band at all. So they said, hey, look, let's just put it right here. We don't know nothing about you. We'll just part ways. You don't know us anything. You're free to get, you know, another record label deal. So that's what we did. And first, nobody wanted nothing to do with us. And ironically, Capitol Records signed us. Ray Tuscan, who was the A&R guy there at the time, he came and saw us at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano out here. And Capitol Records had already passed on signing the band. And the thing is they're the sister affiliate of EMI America. There's no Capitol Records in Europe, it's EMI America, and there's no EMI here, it's Capitol Records. So it was really weird. So he went and saw us, it was sold out, people were going crazy. And he said, you know, I believe in my heart of hearts that you guys have something in you that's special, that's going to do something. I could, you know, back in the day when people used to feel it in their heart, it wasn't all about the business thing. It was like what you can feel and what you can sense. And, you know, so he went and signed a record deal with us. And we actually re-released the Shot in the Dark record, but we didn't push that. We decided to start fresh and do Once Bitten. I said Shot in the Dark was already out for a little while. It didn't make sense. He's like, okay, here it is again on Capitol.
Yeah,
you know, so that's what we ended up doing, the Once Bitten album first.
So what was, do you ever get feedback of why nobody was interested in the band?
Like, I guess the management had played a game with the record labels, like, well, this label is willing to do this for us and give us this much. How much are you willing to, you know, they were bargaining. This is what I heard. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Bargaining with different labels and stuff. And it kind of pissed them off. So, you know, they went with EMI, and then once they got dropped, and then they tried to reshop the band to the same record companies that kind of got, you know, shuffled and played around with. Just said, thanks, but no thanks. We're not interested. We're not interested. We're not interested. I saw all the letters that were returned to us. And yeah, and that's why I said Ray Tuscan came out and just saw us at the Coach House and was very impressed and said, I'm willing to put my reputation on the line and sign you guys because I believe you have what it takes to really do something.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's interesting.
We might not even be having this conversation right now.
Right. That's interesting because there were so many bands at that time getting signed. And, you know, the bands that, in my opinion, that went on and did bigger things, they all had a unique sound to them, I think. And Great White was one of the bands that also when you heard Jack sing, you knew it was Great White. It wasn't like the regular LA strip bands. You know what I mean?
Exactly. He had this quality of a voice you knew was
the yeah. Band. So I'm surprised that they passed on you guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, it worked out for the better, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So here you are, you're on Capitol Records now. You're getting ready to go in and record Once Bitten.
Yes.
Tell me about that process, the recording process with that. Did you have the songs already going in, or were you writing in the studio?
Well, we had songs going in, but we never really had lyrics for any of the songs. So just by luck, every time I do a basic track, it just happened to be played and landing the fills in the right spot. So it wasn't clashing with the singer at all, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much how it was always done for the longest time. I didn't know clue what the lyrics were going to be or what the melody was going to be. So I'm just playing with the bass player and the rhythm guitars and stuff. We're just playing instrumentals. I have an idea what the verses and stuff is, but, you know, I know what he's going to be singing and how he's going to sing it. And, you know what I mean? So I need to be where I can play, and where I don't play is when he's singing, you know? And mm-hmm. So you got to be tasteful in that respect. So yeah, all the records were like that. We're Once Bitten the same way. I didn't really know what the lyrics were going to be.
Wow. Yeah. Did anybody but Jack know, or maybe he didn't even know what the lyrics were going to be?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, you know, the guys like Mark and Michael, the songs they wrote, I know they for sure knew in their mind what the melody was going to be like, you know, and they probably hummed it to me a million times before, but you know, I was learning the song myself. So, but it just always seemed to work out for us that way. Not the lyrics exactly per se and the melody and all that.
Wow. So when you're recording this album, did you know when you're recording like Rock Me and Save Your Love, did you hear or have a feeling that these songs were going to be special? Or was it
No, I was just happy to be doing a record in another one, you know, on Capitol. And so, it was exciting. You know, it's such a long time ago. It's hard for all the feelings that I had then and the things that I went through. But it was really cool. I mean, especially doing Rock because, you know, it was a song. It was 7 minutes and 10 seconds long, you know, and that's really long for any. Actually, DJs used to use it to take a bathroom break. So we can, you know,
helping them out.
Come back and, you know, the song will still be playing, hopefully.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember when the record execs from Capitol came in to hear a rough of that song, they just like lit up like the 4th of July. Like, oh my god, this song is amazing, this is gonna be, you know, this is gonna be big. And it was that kind of excitement that trickled all through the Capitol Records tower that helped that record get to where, you know, it got, you know. It was so that was pretty neat. I didn't have any idea that was a song they were gonna go crazy over, you know. And well, like once when we did Once Been Twice Shy, I was telling all my friends, like, yeah, this is our first single, but, you know, we got all these other really cool songs, you know, for the next singles after this, you know, like, because I didn't really care for the song at the time. I had no idea it was going to do what it did, you know.
Did you like Rock Me or no?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Loved Rock Me. It builds, you know, it starts with quarter notes and then eighth notes and then it moves and it does these different fills and it comes back down. It's like a little journey, you know.
It's not a classic song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a great song. It's a fun song to play, you know, every night for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So after Once Bitten, you recorded it. Now, I remember back in the day when I was young, every band I went to see, you seemed to be opening up for them.
Yes.
Like, you guys were on every show. I was like, again?
Yeah, I mean, television shows and stuff like that?
No, like live concerts. Like every band I went to see, Great White was the opening act.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, we did have a history. I mean, the first band when I got in Great White, we toured with, we opened for, was Night Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And we did Night Ranger shows, fairs and stuff like that. And when they had days off, we went and did clubs. Like, I remember we did like 13, 14 shows in a row back then. I don't know if I can do that now, but that was quite the experience. We definitely got very tight, you know, playing like that every night together.
Yeah. You know?
And and then we went from there. We did a month with Twisted Sister, and that's the tour that we went gold, certified gold on for the One Spittin' album. And then I remember everybody's trying to get on the big Whitesnake tour, and we got that tour, and it worked so well that they kept us on for over 6 months. You know,
that was the Whitesnake album, right? Just the Whitesnake. Yes. Yeah. I was there. Yeah.
That tour, and somehow our management did his magic, and we got that tour, and it worked out so well with the crew and the bands and everything, and the attendance. Because we're the openers, usually people are starting to get there. It's just the opener. Mm-hmm. But it was usually about 75-80% full by the time we played. And that was like 7:30 in the evening most of the time. So we did have a help in the sales.
Did you see the crowds growing when your time slot was on as the tour went and as the band was building momentum?
Well, I mean, like I said, it was almost full every time we open the show on these arenas with Whitesnake. It was just a rush, just period, just to be, you know, in 10, 15,000 seaters of, you know, people screaming. It's a total rush. It's nothing like it.
Yeah. How long were you on the road for that record?
Over 8 months. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
I know we did 6-7 months with Whitesnake, maybe even, no, but probably about 6 months. The Twisted Sister was up, that was a month, and then we, I think Whitesnake, Night Ranger, well, I know we had the Shot in the Dark, but I wasn't sure if we were doing the One Spittin' at the time yet. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a good year for sure.
So they let you work that record. They didn't want to get you off the road to go record the next follow-up record real quick.
Right, yeah.
Because I hear that story a lot. They pull you off the road to try to keep that success going with the next record.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you're exhausted from being on the road. It's like, man, give me a break so I can breathe. And then, but then you never know. Sometimes it works better that way. You're just constantly going, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So after that tour, did you guys get a break or did you go right in to record Twice Shy?
We probably had a break. I don't remember that far back that goes.
Uh-huh.
But we were pretty consistent every year doing, you know, at least every 2 years, maybe. I'd have to look on the album dates.
Yeah. So now you're recording Twice Shy and Once Bitten Twice Shy. It was your biggest single, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a cover song. Now, whose idea was it to do this cover song?
My manager.
And was there any pushback by you guys, or you just said okay?
No, Dan earlier that I never really cared for the song the way I heard it, and I didn't even really understand what he was singing the lyrics. I thought he was talking about Twice Shopping or something, not One Bit Twice Shy. It was just there's accent, and I'm like, you know, I never really pay attention to the lyrics, so I'm like, he's saying, you know, people sing the wrong chorus all the time to songs. That's what I was doing with that song. And until I found out, you know, what the title was. And of course, the first album was Went Spit, and the second after that was Twice Shy. It made sense. And like I said, who knew it was going to sell like crazy and, you know, just go, you know, gold just on the single by itself. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And here you are still playing that song.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of the songs you have to play. I mean, every band has a song they have to play, like Metallica has to play Enter Sandman, you know.
Yeah.
It is that kind of
thing. Yeah, I get it.
And a lot of bands are tired of it, but hey, it's like, you know, that's the song that helped get me my house, and it's not a pain.
Yeah.
You know, really, that's what they want to hear. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, was it during that album you guys did the MTV Unplugged?
Well, whenever the we did one of the first ones.
Mm-hmm.
Don Henley and Damn Yankees and us. That was the first taping, I believe, the MTV Unplugged. That was Twice Shy. Okay. Remember, we played Once Bitten, Twice Shy, and we played House of Broken Love, and I forgot what the other song was that we played.
We did a Zeppelin cover.
Zeppelin cover, yeah. And we kind of rehearsed it in the green room. I never played it before, but I heard it a million times. And I just kept looking at Michael and have him cue me when to stop and when to start again. You know, because it's just weird when there's like 50 people in a studio all around you and you're playing a song you just don't really know.
Oh, that's got to be a bad feeling.
A lot of pressure, but, you know, an adrenaline
I mean,
rush.
I guess it's a little easier for a drummer, right? You just got to play a beat. You don't have to worry about hitting the wrong note.
No, but it's just starting and stopping when you're supposed to. Yeah. On that song, there's a lot of stopping and starting. And so, you know, if you're not familiar with it, I mean, I've heard it a million times, but,
yeah,
you know, it was fun to do. I mean, we added that to the set and we won two with Whitesnake and stuff. People went crazy.
Yeah, I remember that song. I remember when you guys did it and it was like a big thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounded great.
Nail Zeppelin all day long. You
know? Yeah. 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 Was that a fun gig to do, the Unplugged stuff, or was it more stressful than fun?
I never did anything like that before. Like I said, it was weird having people behind you, and it's just not thousands of people. It's like 50 people in a little studio.
Mm-hmm.
Like with a microscope, I felt like his eyes on my back, you know. Usually when you're playing, you know, a venue, it's just they see in front of you, but behind you, just it's all your own little world back there, but not in that Unplugged thing. It's all around you. Top of the Pops was the same way too. There was people on balcony behind me. There's a show called Top of the Pops that we did, and we did all those late night talk show things. It was pretty fun.
Yeah. And then you guys released, was it called Hooked? Was the next one?
Hooked, yes.
Okay. Now that wasn't as successful as the previous two, but that's when things were kind of shifting though.
Yeah, I mean, just a lot of stuff with, well, not the grunge stuff yet. That was the Sail Away album period where Nirvana's and all those bands like that came out and just wiped out the 80s. But the Hooked, yeah. There was, at that particular time, there were some dark times for me. I had substance problems at that time. So it was just a big blur. I actually had to go dry out and re-record stuff and that's all I remember. That every time people go, that's my favorite record. And I'm like, that to me, it's just like such a dark period of my life that's always going to be attached to that record, which is unfortunately a bummer, but you know, my own fault, obviously, but it is what it is. So,
yeah. Now, is that something that was with the band for a while, all the substance abuse and stuff? Cause I know Jackie, you know, everybody knows his stories with
yeah, I mean, we all do that stuff, you know. I'm just glad I was able to just confront everybody and say, hey, I got this problem right in the middle of basic tracks. So they put me up in this apartment for a month to dry out and get my mind back together. Then we redid the drums and it was a lot better than the first attempt, you know. Mm-hmm. It was never the same thing twice. It was awful.
Right. And have you been good since that time?
Oh, yeah. Those days I wouldn't be alive right now if I still did that kind of stuff, you know. Did a lot of cocaine basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not a good thing. But at that period of time in that industry, everybody was doing it. That's not an excuse. I'm not making an excuse, but you know, I just had the money to just keep buying it. And you know.
Yeah. The environment definitely didn't help.
No. I just wish I never even liked that stuff back then. It would just save me so much grief and so much stress and so much money. But I'm just glad that I didn't lose my house. I'm not dead. Yeah. So, you know.
And you appear pretty healthy.
Well, yeah. I try to do the best I can, you know.
Yeah.
You don't get a chance to eat well or sleep much when we go on these weekend warrior runs that we do. But it's just part of the game now. Cause, you know.
Yeah. Do you like the weekend gigs? Or would you rather be on a bus?
I would love to be on a tour bus, you know. Yeah. Two at a time would be great because then I would be always rested.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear. Yeah, I mean, traveling in the airplanes, that's got to be tiring at airports and everything else.
I mean, you know, we headline and we get, you know, we go on for like at 10 o'clock and we're done at 11:30. And then by the time we grab our personal gear and then get rides back to the hotel, you know, it's like 1:30 in the morning. And then we have to be in the lobby at 3:30 or 4:30 in the morning, depending on what time our flights are for the next gig.
Ugh.
We go, you know, and I have so much adrenaline, it takes me 3 to 4 hours to get tired enough to go to sleep. I just turn and try to get some rest, but I try to hope I sleep on the plane for a little time we fly. So we have to get the first flight out of there to go straight to soundcheck to the next gig. You know, and if you don't have any sleep the night before, you're functioning on no sleep.
Yeah.
Soundcheck, if you're lucky enough to take a nap and then grab some food, then go back to the show, and then, you know, whatever you did get to nap on, that's what you're functioning on. Sometimes I don't even get that. So it makes it kind of tough to play, you know, hour and a half when you're just no sleep at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You're thinking about all these songs that you know so well, but you're so tired. It's like, where are we? You know, like we're in the second.
Has it affected you like that? Have you forgotten something?
Oh, I've had stuff like just for seconds, like, oh, we're in the first verse or second verse, or does that feel coming? I'll just do it out of habit and go, okay, that was right.
Oh, you
know, I stop myself because I'm so tired and delirious, and everybody is that way, you know. Oh. And sometimes we play better when we're tired. Relaxed and we're chilled. We've already done a couple shows, and you know, it's not like the bus where you have, you know, you're playing all week every week and you get really tight and polished. We never get to get polished because we go back home for a week, you know, or two. And but this year we've been busy since January already, and that's really rare. We haven't even begun May, June, July, August. We're really get busy.
Yeah, I was looking at your dates and you've got a lot of dates coming up booked already this year.
There's a whole bunch we can't even post yet because they haven't been finalized. But yeah, there's a whole bunch. Yeah. Wow. It's great to be working, but I just, you know, I just want to keep up with it physically. It's tough, especially because airport food and casino food just don't cut it.
It gets old quick.
Yeah. But you got to try to find the healthy stuff wherever you can, but it's hard.
Yeah. Do you ever have a train wreck on stage? Do you ever really screw it up?
I've done a train wreck a couple of times. I remember once in Canada at the end of, actually, when I do those fills going back into the choruses out of Once Bitten, Twice Shy, it's real simple. I just shorted one bar and ended up with a whole bar ahead of everybody. And it was, and I'm going, I'm looking at Mako because he's like the time guy. And he's like, dude, I go, I can't find it. And we ended at the right time. And then, you know, doing meet and greet after the show. And we was like, yeah, that's a real good ending you did there, eh? You know, we're in Canada. And I go, oh, yeah, I know. I'm human. What am I? I'm not a machine. So
you just have to say that. You know, that's not easy to do.
No. Like, oh, here's the sticks. Let me see you try that for an hour and a half. You know, land that just right.
That's funny. Yeah. Now, at what moment, because you left Great White at one point, correct?
Yes.
What was the, two times or one time?
One time. What happened was we got in a, Jack and I got in an argument of words, and then it became a fist fight. And then things were really weird with paying, getting paid, and I was getting paid. I'm like, you know, I'm not going to do the next show and not get paid. You know, so they just found a couple of people to replace me. And actually, Sean McNabb, the bass player at the time, felt the same way. So we just didn't go, and they got some other people to replace us. And then I got some letter from the tour manager at the time saying that, this was after I got in a fist fight with him and then refused to go on to do the show. He says, due to refusing to do these upcoming shows and causing Jack Russell physical body harm or whatever, your services are no longer required for the bands. And it just signed this, you know, tour manager guy. It wasn't a lawyer or nothing. It was like, whatever, horseshit. It's like, whatever. And then I called our lawyer and he goes, well, I can't talk to you because the bands retained me against you. You have to find your own counsel. I'm like, okay, whatever. And so, And then luckily that happened. And then, you know, the band disbanded, and then they got back together, and that's when that fire happened. And, you know, I wasn't involved in any of that, but it was really weird because I was at that time doing construction with a good friend of mine, just demoing this restaurant. And I remember it was really hot, and I was dumping all this drywall in one of those big walk-through dumpsters. And I was like, this sucks, man. I'm here busting my ass doing this stuff. And I'm a drummer, man. I should be out there playing. I go, Jack and Mark are out there right now, touring right now. And as soon as I got home from that job, my whole message machine was full of people going, dude, are you okay? I heard Great White got fired, 100 people died, and look on channel CNN, and I turn on the TV. I'm like, whoa, all this happened when I was sitting there envying them, you know, and then I go, I'm so glad I wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I would have been one of those guys to go, oh, my drums, I got to run back in and make sure they don't get, and then I'd die, you know.
Isn't that what happened to Ty?
That's what I heard. Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't there, but that's what I heard. Yeah, that's awful. I have a friend of mine here that died. I didn't know till 6 months after that. He went in there to go find his girlfriend, and she was already out, but he thought he was in. She was in, so he ran in there to find her, and he, of course, didn't make it back out. And he was already out as well.
Mm. So that was so sad. Yeah. Now, speaking of that, that was Jack Russell's Great White, right?
Correct.
So, but it's still going to haunt Great White, right?
I'm sorry?
It's still haunting Great White, though.
Oh, it totally destroyed us.
Yeah.
We're forever plagued. It's because of the fact that the documentary that they put out, it's all lies. It says it was Great White, Great White, Great White, Great White. Even the little club they played at, it's one of those little tiny marquees with those little light bulbs all around on a trailer. And they had those little plastic letters that said, tonight, Great White. It didn't say Jack Russell's Great White, but on his dressing room door, the flyers that they provide every night says Jack Russell's Great White. His merchandise said Jack Russell's tour, whatever. But because of that marquee, when CNN got there, they just flashed the camera in that marquee, and it was boom. It was Great White that did that. No question about it. And if you were to try to argue that today, that, are you just trying to, you know, it was, you know, Jack Russell is Great White, so it was Great White. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Those guys that were in his band had nothing to do with any of those songs, writing, or anything.
Yeah. You know,
they didn't even mention in the documentary who those people were on stage with him on that particular night. They actually showed a flyer of the band, me, Tony Montana, Michael Lardy, Jack, and Mark, from a gig from, you know, back in our heyday for that show. In the newspaper. So they show that on the documentary. So I was livid, and I was going to call the station going, you need to blur my face out of there. You're insinuating that I had something to do with the responsibility of 100 people's deaths. I don't want that on my head. I want some crazy guy to Molotov cocktail my house one day going, you murder, or I go get shot in the head because this kid grew up and found out this band was responsible for his parents' death. You know, I don't want to be insinuated like that. It was a horrible thing, but I wasn't even there. So my wife called, and she told him that, you know, you need to blur that out like they do in the cops TV show. And so they said, well, it's really expensive to do that. We, you know, can't do that. And then the next time I watched the documentary, that flyer, everybody's face was blurred out except for Jack's. So they actually did it because they knew.
Well, they knew they'd have a lawsuit.
They'd have a lawsuit. And I didn't want to get into that. You know, it was a horrible tragedy. When they try to make money off somebody's tragic.
No, but it probably had a lot of weight on you, even though you weren't involved, but feeling like people were coming down on you for that, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first rejoined the band, I'd be in airports and strangers come up to me. That must have been a really bad thing that happened to you guys. I'm like, I wasn't even there, you know? And that's what they insinuate in that documentary. It's like overkill on it. It's Great White who did this.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't.
Yeah. But, you know. Now, Mark was there, right?
Mark was there,
yeah. But he wasn't in that band.
He wasn't in the band.
Yeah.
When Jack tried to go out there with these other guys, he had really bad attendance. Nobody wanted to come. Nobody cared. So he's like, he called Mark, kept calling Mark, calling Matt, Matt, come on, you got to come out with me, man. You know, help me out here and we could do some great white stuff together. And then, you know, we'll get more people. And so like Mark reluctantly went there and played some shows. And then the next three or fourth show down the road, that fire happened, you know, horrible thing. But he didn't even really want to go do that. You know, Jack just kept begging him and bugging him to you know, come out, man, come out and help me out. And he wasn't actually even getting paid in the first few shows. He had to threaten going, if you don't pay me before I get on stage, I'm not going. I'm just going to go home. Mm. That's what it was, only a few shows and that started happening. And then the next one was the fire.
Wow.
It was a horrible thing. But yeah, he wasn't really, he wasn't in Jack's great white
band. Yeah. Was that his last, was that him and Jack's last show, Mark and Jack's last show together?
No, actually, I heard they tried to do a little van tour to make up whatever, and they weren't greeted well with that. People didn't want them to do that, you know, like just, I don't know the whole, there, I don't know the whole story.
Yeah, yeah.
But I heard they tried to go out and do a little thing to try to help people out financially. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can't put a price on one person's death, you know, it's a little over 100. Crazy.
So after all that happened, when did you guys get back together to do Great White?
I got a call from Jack and he said he just got out of Betty Ford Center and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing a new record and a tour. And that's it. That was it. That was all he asked me if I'm interested. And I said, you're sober now. And, you know, it's, the band that had gone by a little while, but still, like you said, it was still fresh. But I wasn't really thinking about that. But we ended up doing a record and a tour. And that was like, 16, 17 years ago. And I'm still doing it. It was supposed to be one more record and a tour. You know, I didn't know I was going to keep, you know, through several other singers and stuff, unfortunately. But
yeah. So, what happened with that Jack, did Jack leave the band for the last time or did you guys move on?
Well, he claims he left the band. We had to the point where we had to do 7 shows without Jack there at all. So we wouldn't get sued. Cause we had, you know, contracts for all these shows to do. And we got to the point where he was like falling off the stage and it was just really bad. And you know, I'm trying to bag on the guy. He had a problem. He deliberately set out to sabotage anybody. You know, it just happens when you have addictions and stuff. But he would just refuse to go on the next flight, or he would like get sent to the hospital because he needed something because he was hurting or something. I don't know. So we ended up having to do one show without him, and our manager was like, most of those were all fairs, so it was like, you know, people pay to go in the fair and, hey, Great White happens to be playing here. So it wasn't so much like I'm paying to go specifically see Great White. So we kind of got away with it, so to speak. Our management would say, hey, you know, I got to let you know the band's there. They're going to do sound check. They're ready to go, but Jack can't make it there. The doctor says he can't be there. He's ill, but yeah, we'll still be able to handle the show. And the promoter will go, yeah, okay, go for it. So we'd do 2 songs, and after the second song, Michael would go, hey, you probably, you know, notices the, you know, Jack's not here, you know, but he can't make it. He's ill, and he didn't want to disappoint. And he said for us to just go ahead and rock you guys. And so each, you know, Mark, Scotty, and Michael took turns doing lead vocals for the songs.
Oh, geez. I was going to ask who was singing. Okay.
All 3 of them took turns, ones that they can pretty much handle. And we, you know, we got pretty good at it, but we didn't like it. It was a lot of pressure and felt really weird, you know.
You didn't want to attempt one?
No.
Peter Criss style?
No, I couldn't do it. Only time I ever sang was some backups that I did with Jack when he was 16 years old. His parents paid for a demo of 3 songs. It was a Foreigner song, Double Vision. I sang some falsetto thing and just happened to work out with the bass player, but I never sang again. Yeah, just played. The rest of the guys can sing well, so they can harmonize and they don't need me.
When did Tony leave the band? So he wasn't in the band at this point.
No, he left after Hooked, I believe. Okay. I think he really wanted to start playing guitar again. He was just tired of playing bass.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guitar player originally, you know, and that's his first love. And then when he had an opportunity, because he taught bass in a music store, when he found out, you know, because I could play the bass. So he auditioned, and it worked out for like 5 years with him. Mm-hmm. But I think he was tired of, you know, just playing the bass. He just like loved playing guitar. It's, you know.
Sure. Yeah, he's playing guitar with Jack now, right?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Strange, yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, so now that Jack's gone, I mean, what was your first thought? What were you guys going to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, what happened was we can't get rid of the lead singer. He's the sound, recognizable sound of the whole band, you know what I mean? And nobody's going to buy that. But after about a year and a half, like him like not wanting to go, or are we going to do the show or not do the show, or is he back in the hospital? Is he this? Is that? And just after a while, I was like, it shouldn't, you know, we all have mortgages to pay. We can't just like, whatever, dude, you know, we'll wait, you know? So we just said, we got to do something, man. So we just said, hey, we're going to get somebody else, man. You know, we can't, it's just a business. It's, you know, it's not about the friend thing. You know, we need somebody we can count on and rely on to do the show and you know, entertain and make people feel like they're getting their money's worth. You know,
right. Was that a hard decision?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, the tone of your band, the guy's voice is like everybody knows it's Jack Russell. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hard to do, but we're like, hey, you know, we're never going to be guaranteed doing all these shows. It's hit or miss. And whenever Jack's going to be okay to do a show, we're going to go. And there'll be times I'm all ready to go, and then my manager goes, "Oh, no shows this weekend." I'm like, "What?" Because yeah, Jack's back in the hospital. I'm like, shit. So it was like that all the time. And it was really hard to, you know, to rely on that. And it was really a lot of anxiety and stress every weekend. Like, are we going to do it? Are we not going to do it? Is he going to get here? Are we going to make it to the plane? We're on stage now. Oh, we're going to do the show. Oh, you know, that's how it got. Yeah. And then we had, Terry, I guess. Terry Luce.
Yeah, I've had Terry on the show. Great guy.
Yeah, great guy. Great voice, too. He's awesome. We had Terry, I think, for 8 years, I think.
And how did you hook up with Terry? I mean, did you go after him, or did he?
I didn't even know Terry at all. I heard of the band XYZ, but I wasn't familiar with any of it. But our booking agent knows him and suggested, you know, maybe we get together and see if it worked out. And at this point, it was like, the guy's standing up. He's not going to fall off the stage. And he's, you know, it's like, yes, you know, I mean, he doesn't sound anything like Jack. It's night and day.
Yeah. It's totally different.
He's really, really, really good. Really bluesy and very, you know, very talented singer. Absolutely. But the whole time he was with us, it's like, I constantly get emails from people and fans like, oh, you need to get Jack back. He's not the same. And this guy doesn't fit. And, you know, he's a little French guy from Europe. I mean, everybody's just going to see the for guy Jack from California. You know what I mean? And every time we'd play, I'd see people in the front row, like all kind of like puzzled looking and like not knowing how to feel. It was like really weird. And this went on and on and on. I'm like, it's so weird. Why doesn't anybody like us? This guy can sing awesome. You know, and plus we had 2 records with them, new music and everything.
But at this point, people they want to mainly hear the older stuff that they know.
Yeah. And that's the way that it is to this day. You know, we get to be nostalgic. You know, people want to relive memories of their youth and what was happening in the marriage or sexual encounters or whatever happened in their life songs. You help me not kill myself. I hear people I was going to. You know, it's really amazing some of the things people tell you about what your music does to them or help them do.
Yeah, yeah. So you do 2 records with Terry, and then did you guys dismiss him or did he leave?
Well, we kind of dismissed him. It was just a personality thing. I mean, the guy, to me, is a great artist. nothing I can say bad about the guy. His voice, his singing, he's talented, great guy, professional on stage. The guy, even when he's deathly sick with a fever, he'll go out there and just kick ass, even put more into it than when he's not sick. He's just that kind of guy. But yeah, just off the music, I don't know.
It just wasn't gelling.
Just wasn't gelling. It got to a point where, like, you know, we just didn't want to deal anymore. And it was nothing to do with his talent whatsoever. You know, just didn't work out.
But then you went from Terry to Malloy, right? Mitch Malloy?
Well, we had Janie Lane for a little while.
That's right. You did. How long was he with you guys?
He did quite a few dates with us, including Europe. And it was a trip because I was never a big fan. And then I never really, I don't know, I had any respect for him. I didn't know Janie Lane at all. But then after he worked with us, like, I gained this whole new respect for the guy. He's very talented, very so creative. Talented. Mm-hmm. And he learned verbatim every nuance that Jack sang in his own way, you know, just hitting, just like the record, not trying to stray from it. And of course, his girlfriend at the time was a huge fan, so she, like, drilled him on it. Nope, nope, that's not the part. No, do it like that part, you know. So he was, like, really perfected on it. So, and then in the middle of our set, we let him go by himself with his acoustic guitar and do a medley of all of the Warrant hits.
Great. So
it was kind of, it was like you see how two bands at once, you know, kind of like the people in Europe, not too big in that, but in America, they dug it.
Is there clips out there with him singing with you guys?
Yeah, there's one in Europe in this big, giant, ancient bullfighting arena. It's huge, and it was packed with people. They had one of their guys, I can't even remember what country. Was it Portugal? I think it was Portugal. You have to look up, like, Great White, I Can't Shake It, Live in Portugal. I think that's what it's, yeah, Live in Portugal, Great White, Can't Shake It's the one song that I know for sure is, I think there's a whole show, but there's one particular video of that. It looks really cool. They actually, the guy's way back there up in the nosebleed. He has this big zoom lens in the, so he looks like he's really close.
Oh, wow.
And then halfway through the show, he pulls back and you see this huge place of people. It was really cool.
Wow. I'm going to have to look that up because I don't think I've ever heard him sing with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, he did pretty well. And yeah, and he had one more show to do this, and then he died.
Oh, no. And
Terry came and did the, it was New Year's Eve up in Michigan, way up near Canada somewhere. Not Michigan, somewhere up near Canada, north of Minneapolis. I don't know. But yeah, so then we got Terry for like 8 years. And then, yeah, the Mitch Malloy thing was kind of a surprise to me. I remember seeing him. I remember seeing this long hair with big, giant white teeth from a distance. Oh, and one of the Monsters of Rock cruises that we were on. I guess he was there. I didn't know he was a solo guy, had Mitch Malloy or whatever thing going. But it's funny because he would play Once Bitten, Twice Shy, and Terry invites him on stage to do the choruses with us. And then the next thing I knew, the guy's, he's our singer.
They don't even consult with you on this?
Well, no. But I guess Michael had arranged to where he had Mitch sing three or four of the Great White songs in our set in the studio. He sent up somebody. Mitch had a studio in his house, so he, and it sounded great. You know, I'm going, yeah, cool. I'm thinking, yeah, this sounds awesome. You know what I mean? This guy could totally handle it. He's blind. He looks like, you know, American dude. He should be fine. And then, and he came to rehearse with us in person. And Scotty, I went, oh, shit.
Oh, no.
I just got, not like I thought. It didn't sound nothing like the studio. Of course, in the studio, you can make everything perfect. Sure. Because you don't have to try that hard. But, you know, it worked out for a while. You know, did, you know, totally different worlds. You know, he was cool to me and stuff, but we just didn't fit well at all. The person just clashed central, You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was no chemistry at all.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So at this point, you're on your third singer after Jack. So what's going through your head now? I mean, because it's going to be like, okay, forget about it.
It gets ridiculous that nobody respects you anymore. And you just don't be taken serious anymore. Yeah. It sucks. It sucks. I mean, I don't, if it's done, it's done. I would have loved it if it was Jack stayed his shit together to where we just kept going, but that's not, and it's done, it's done. Terry done. Mitch is definitely done. And then we got Andrew Freeman from Last in Line, and he's a monster singer too.
But that was real brief.
Very, very brief.
Yeah.
Only because of tour clashing. I mean, we would have kept him the whole time, but he wanted to do this lab that now he's invested in. He's part owner of the band, and they just did this record, and they're gonna have dates. Like, well, we can't let you do your dates and wait around, and then we do our dates with you. It's like, we want to do our own dates when we have our dates, and you're going to do your dates when you have your dates. So that ended like that.
Mm-hmm. And now you've got Brett in the band, young kid.
Yeah, young kid. A friend of mine manages his other band that he's been in for 5 years. He started as a kid. He's still a kid. Yeah. And he goes, man, he goes, the singer Brett could totally handle this stuff. I go, oh, give it a try. What do we got to lose at this point? You know, and he fits really well. I mean, you know, the kid's young, he's got a huge range. And when you're that age, you can hit all those notes, no problem, for many, many years or forever if you take care of yourself.
Yeah.
So it's working fine. You know, he's totally pleasing the crowd that way. You know, when, like you said, they want to come and they want to reminisce and get nostalgic about, you know, where they're at in their life when those songs were out. And he's as close as the singer we've gotten to can emulate the Jack sound as much as possible. Never anybody being Jack, or, you know what I'm saying? It's just... Yeah. You got to get somebody that sounds just like Journey has the guy that sounds, you know, mm-hmm. like Steve Perry and with Foreigner, what's his name? He has it down to where, you know, and a lot of people don't even know that the Foreigner band is even any original guys in it anymore.
That's so crazy, isn't it? I don't know, understand how that works.
Yeah. I mean, Molly Hatchet, we played with. There's nobody original in that band.
How does that happen? I mean, how do you
most of
go on?
The crew, what I think, from what I heard, you know, we played a few times with them, but it's trippy. I'm like, oh, these guys aren't even all the same guy. I mean, and I'm freaking out because we only have, you know, we don't have all the same people we have. But
you got
three out of five. That's not
pretty
bad.
Good.
Yeah, but no more than that, though. That's cutting it, you know. But yeah.
Yeah, I always believe that if there's five people, if there's less than half the people, original guys in the band, it's not the same band.
That's no. Yeah. Well, even like Judas Priest, I mean, they got different guitar players. Well, the drummer's amazing, Scott. But the guitar players, I can tell they're not the same guys anymore. You know, there's no KK, there's no Tipton. These guys are great, but they're not those guys. And I don't expect them to be. But it gives them a different.
Yeah. There's a reason the bands with the original guys become so successful, because you have to have that camaraderie. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
They have to gel together. And when you think of a KK and a Rob and Glenn, that's Judas Priest, you know?
Yep. Exactly. So. Yeah.
But so I listened to some of your new stuff online. I looked up some of the shows with Brett singing, and I thought he sounded like you said. I think he's the best thing you've had since Jack was in the band.
Yeah. I mean, you know, nobody's going to be Jack, but he's going to emulate the sounds and the tones that Jack was able to achieve. So mm-hmm. that it works. It works out great, you know.
Yeah.
And Brett's a really nice guy. He's very mature for he's younger than my son.
Is he?
Yeah, and 5 years older than my oldest granddaughter.
So what's it like on the road with you guys being so far different in age? Are you wanting to go back to the hotel and he wants to just stay up and do something? Or
he likes to hang out and hang out at the bars and float around and stuff. He's a single guy.
Yeah.
Right now, Scott, our bass player, is recovering from back surgery. So Brett's bass player from AON is out filling in for Scott. So he's got a buddy now. So when we get done playing, they're gone hanging somewhere.
Maybe one day they're going to be the Great White with no original members.
That's what I was saying. They could eventually replace. We could replace ourselves with these guys from his band, and they can be like, the Foreigner of their time. I don't know.
You never know, right?
Yeah. Interesting things have happened, it just gets harder to do when you get older, especially the way we do it now. Like I'm saying, if we had a tour bus all this time, it'd be a breeze.
Yeah.
You don't have to show every night, no problem. Got to get, at least get in the bed right away and not just, lay around for hours. I mean, I could at least on the bus watch a movie, get sleepy, then go lay down and crash out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wake up at a hotel. So
are you? You haven't recorded any studio stuff with Brett, have you?
Not yet. No, we were planning to get together a month ago when we had some time off, and then Mark got ill. I think he had the flu or COVID or something. None of us wanted to get together at that point, so we're going to postpone it. We're going to get together. We all have ideas to put out there and see what we come up with.
When's the last time you guys wrote original stuff?
The last time was when we did the Full Circle album with Terry.
Okay.
We can like get our ideas and send it to each other's studio and lay down the track and send it back. But I told these guys, I want to be all together, real live people. Because I believe, you can still make it sound great, but there's a certain thing missing of the people together. I haven't really been able to listen to stuff to see if I can hear the differences, of bands recorded versus sending the tracks out to each other in their own studio by themselves. I don't know. It's just kind of weird. I don't know. Maybe I'm just old fashioned, but I just believe being in the room, playing it live together is the best way to do things.
Do you have a studio at your house?
A little small, bare bones, old Pro Tools. We barely know how to run it, but Michael knows how to do stuff. I have everything all hooked up. I have one room with the drums in it, with a snake going through the wall, and the Pro Tools are on the other side. Got cameras on each room so you can see each other. Headphone amps, all that stuff. It's all mic'd up, ready to go. So we could just start doing live demos right off the bat to come over.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely pros and cons to both ways, I think, recording. Recorded both ways.
No possible way to do anything. Like a lot of people learned that during COVID. They started putting music jams out all day long. It was kind of cool. Couldn't physically all get together. So people got really good at it. So.
Do you think, let me ask you this. I'm not going to ask you if you're going to get a reunion with Jack. Ask you that because I pretty much know that answer. But would you record a studio song with Jack again?
Oh, we wouldn't have to see each other, would we?
No, maybe not, right?
No, you wouldn't, because every album we ever did, I was never really there when he did his vocal tracks. When I was done with my drums, I was gone. I didn't hang around through the whole periods of everybody's. It's like long days. I'd get really bored. So I just, I would split. So actually I did hang for the last records, the Full Circle and the ones with Terry, the other ones we did, the Elation record. I was just more into it at that time. Back in the day in our heyday, I'm done with my tracks. I'm going to go party. So that was gone. But I don't know.
I'm just asking as a fan. I don't know. I know it's different with you guys, and what goes on. I don't know. But as a fan, I would love to hear something with all those guys again, you know, and that's why I was asking.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the other guys would do, but I know they don't want to do anything live with the with sure. him.
Understandable.
But you know, you could do something like that in a studio. You wouldn't have to see each other. You know, music could all be done. He'd come in by himself and sing the track, and then boom, there'd be a song. But I don't know what good that would do for anybody. I mean, diehard fans would dig it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be basically for your fans.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, you know. And fun. You guys might have fun.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to get in the studio with Brett, though, because
yeah.
he's got a lot of fire, a lot of energy, and somebody, a lot of good ideas, too. So.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be interested in checking that out.
Because it's going to be him not trying to sound like Jack.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a little different sounding. You know what I mean? We're not going to be, every song you sing, you got to try to sound like if Jack would sing it. You know what I mean? That's yeah. not going to, he's got to
no, be. No, I think it would be different. Cause if you listen to All or Nothing stuff, his voice sounds different than what I heard live.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know? I mean, yeah. maybe because he's singing Great White Stuff, he's doing more of the Great White thing, and on yeah. his stuff, he's doing his own thing. But
true.
But cool. Okay. Well, tell me about, you've got some coffee as well, right?
Yeah, I do. I don't have it. I sold all my bags, so here's the label. Uh-oh.
Oh, it disappeared. You get eaten by a shark?
Two things at once. That's weird. Anyway, yes, that's really weird. I can't hold things up. But yeah, that's the label. I just ordered some more. I ordered like another 35 pounds. It's not a lot, but
yeah.
You know, I had, the band had three kinds of coffee, you know, titled, it was Face of Day Special Blend, Rock Me Roast, and Big Time Brew. Light, medium, and dark roast. But the people that were making our coffee, bagging it and all that, for the 10 years we were together, they've been selling our coffee behind our backs and never telling me. So all they were supposed to do was they'd get the beans from a company, they'd pack it, bag it and everything, and just I'd give them the money, they'd hand me the bags. But they had coffee carts, and they would go to all these venues and different places at Christmas time and races and all this stuff for years and years, selling Great White Coffee and never mentioning it once. The way they got caught was they were selling it to Europe. And I got a bunch of emails from people from Europe going, we still haven't gotten our orders for the coffee. I'm going, that's funny. We don't sell the coffee to Europe because it's way too much to ship it. They were able to sell it cheaper because they were, you know, they got it cheaper, you know, they were sell it for what we sold ours. But yeah, so that's how I caught them. And I actually confronted, I used to go out with her husband for sushi all the time, and we were like hanging out, friends and stuff. And so before I found this out, he had mentioned about 6 months earlier that she kind of cut him out of all the coffee dealings, but he knew what was going on. But I go, what the hell are you selling a coffee behind her back and not telling me, not giving me any money? I go, you have no right to do that. You're not licensed to sell a coffee. She goes, I've never not fulfilled an order. Totally admitting that she was selling her coffee.
Just didn't give you any money or let you know.
You guys are freaking dead to me. Don't ever come around me. Don't ever sell coffee again. I'm going to let everybody know you're thieves. She goes, well, I'll write you a check. I go, I don't want your freaking money. Just fuck off. I don't want nothing to do with you. I don't want it. So, it didn't really sell a lot because it cost a lot to ship it for bag. It's like a novelty item. You know, it was good coffee. I decided on my website to sell my own coffee, and I donate a few bucks on it to different, like, Humane Society and PETA and all these different places, and a lot of basic, like, shelters, like, not just big organizations, but smaller places, like, that people that have bring their cats and dogs to Petco and stuff. Because I love animals. I love cats, especially. I have two cats. We had two that just passed away 6 months apart from cancers.
Oh, no.
We got two little kitties. They're almost 10 months old. They're giant now. Just regular little cats. Yeah. But they're totally opposite the last two cats we had. But so I just sell this coffee. It's I'm not really a huge coffee drinker, but I will have coffee with breakfast, you know, when I go out. But and then now and then I'll make some here at home of this coffee. But my wife drinks coffee like crazy, and she says it's really great.
Why did you want to do a coffee?
I don't know. Just something to sell. Just stuff. I have my little website because I handle all the band's website stuff, the ordering, designing, all that stuff. And I see the money that the band generates. I'm like, well, I could have my own website and get a little piece, you know, because I'm not the band, but I can make a few bucks here and there. So I need to have some interesting things. So I go, well, people drink coffee, so I'll sell coffee. And I have T-shirts and stickers and little things like signed drum heads, drum sticks, stuff like that. Just a little side gig, not a whole lot of stuff, but just to keep people involved and, you know, keep in touch with different fans and stuff.
Right. And that's at desbroland.com is your
website. Yeah, Desbro. Yeah.
So people can go there. They can get the coffee. They can get the signed drum heads, the shirts, all that.
Sticks, everything like that. Yeah. Some cool stuff. We also, the band, like I said, behind me, I have a sample of one of our newest jerky flavors. We sell beef jerky. It's a weird thing to sell. I know. It's like, why is Great White selling beef jerky?
Yeah, I'm interested. Okay. I'm intrigued on that. Why?
Okay. Well, the thing a while back when Jack tried to sue us for the ownership of Great White, the name of the band, we spent lots of money in federal court fighting to defend it, and we actually won the case. We own the name. So after we won the name, I talked to our attorney several times and said, what do you do with the name? You know, you own the name, you know, sell something, make something, do something. You know, you spent all that money, you know, not it's just not on the band, but you can name whatever you want Great White, you know, it's mm-hmm. yours. So I go, okay. So I started out with doing the beer. We did beer for a while. We had, it was Once Bitten IPA and Twice Shy Blonde Ale. Hmm. And they sold four packs. I had it in a few bars and a few markets. Of course, it was really hard. You couldn't really ship it anywhere. Mm-hmm. Couldn't really sell it online. But my whole dream was to, every place we played, to have Great White beer on tap at the venue. But I learned a lot of licensing, a lot of money. It wouldn't even be worth it to try, you know, even if I could break even, but most venues go, why would we want to sell your beer? We're making plenty of money on our own bar.
Yeah. Why?
It would have to be negotiated at the time of the band's hiring, you know, and that's a lot of extra work for the agent to deal with and a lot of red tape. And so we did that for a while and the company decided they didn't no longer wanted to make the beer for us. So that parted ways. And then I did the coffee, you know, and like I said, that's expensive to ship. And then I didn't know I was getting ripped off for a decade. I'm sure not tons and thousands of dollars, but enough, you know, than I would think over 10 years, I'm sure.
That's a long time. But,
anyways, the jerky. So I'm really good friends with the guy who makes does our merchandising, all our T-shirts and stuff. We've been doing business for many, many years now. And every time he knows everybody because everybody has their shirts made there. Every business you can think of, he knows somebody in the car industry, in the construction, and this and that, concrete, whatever, food, bars, everything. So he goes, hey, he used to, the Alien Jerky on the way to Las Vegas. There's this big giant building. It looks like a spaceship. It's got all these aliens and weird spacey stuff. And they sell this alien jerky there. It's like a tourist trap on the way back and forth to Las Vegas off the freeway. And this company made the beef jerky for this alien jerky, but they sold the company and moved out here near Redlands, California. Anyways, they had shirts made. They're called Carnivore Candy, and their logo was a dinosaur, T-Rex. And he goes, these people that make this jerky are big fans of Great White. And he should be totally into making a jerky for the band. I go, oh, all right, let's make some jerky for the band. I like beef jerky. What makes it really cool is it's not like the kind you hang and dry. It's like stew leather, you know, no flavor. This stuff's made really fresh. And it's gonna, you know, last for a year. But like, this is the newest one. I can't show you everything, but it's, anyways, it looks just like the backdrop. It's called Big Time Western. It's actually their traditional Western jerky, but I changed the names, the titles to half of our name of the songs and then the jerky itself. So we got Big Time Western. We got Mr. Teriyaki. It's a teriyaki.
I like that one.
And then we got Whiskey Bitten Twice Shy. It's a whiskey flavored jerky. And then we got the, for Desert Moon, we have Desert Jalapeno. And then for Call It Rock and Roll, we have Call It Black Pepper. And for the Rolling Stone, we have Rolling Sriracha Style, which is a bacon type of jerky. It's actually looks like pieces of bacon.
Oh, wow.
They have like 45 different flavors. They have chicken and turkey jerky. They have dog treats. They have the sticks. They got everything. But we autograph these, and we sell them at the merch booth, and they just fly off the shelves. And it's funny because you're playing your set, and you see all the people in the audience munching.
Yeah, people eating jerky.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I get shark jerky, but I've had that before. It's nasty.
Mm.
You know, it would be right to have shark jerky for great white.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, they had it, but I don't know how popular it is. But see, what's cool about this, I go, we got the cow on the surfboard, and you can't see it, but... I can move my hand. You can see the cow surfboard just cruising along, and there's this big great white going to eat it. So I figured that's how I can incorporate, you know, the band's name with jerky.
That's so fun. Yeah, I mean, it's a brand. You know, Great White's a brand. So
yeah, I mean, so I'll try different things that they stick. Because I was planning on just narrowing it down to the three top flavors, but everybody seems to be buying all these.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do right now, if you buy a six pack, which is one of each flavor, you can get all of them shipped for $10. But if you buy one, it's $5.99 to ship one bag because the shipping's insane at the post office now. So
I know.
Any money, just like the coffee, it costs me $9 to ship one bag of coffee.
Oh, you know,
if you're 15, you're already over $20.
I've got Rock and Roll and Coffee Show coffee.
That's cool. I've seen that. I'll have to try some of that.
And the shipping is crazy. And I also have, I don't know if you saw this, but I have my Hot Rockin' hot sauce.
Oh, nice.
This is a favorite from a lot of people. But yeah.
I have to try that too because I love hot sauces.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. I love it. The hotter, the better, you know, with the flavor. But yeah.
Yeah. It's so fun. You know, the coffee fit perfect for the show, Rock and Roll Coffee Show.
Sure.
And then I just loved hot sauce. So I was like, well, I need some hot sauce too.
That's awesome. I like that. Yeah, hot sauce is an adventure for sure. Yeah. You know, what's funny, what's ironic is the people that made our coffee, they're called Rock and Roll Coffee Company.
Nuh-uh. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. I'm going to look that up.
When I first saw your show, I went, that's not them, is it? No, it's not. It's Rock and Roll Coffee Show. There's just called Rock Coffee Company.
Oh, all right. Who had it first?
Copyright infringement. I'll give you their address. We'll talk after the show.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. So can they get your coffee on the Great White site as well? I know the beef jerky comes from Great White. What is it? Officialgreatwhite.net.
Yes.
Okay.
.net. The coffee comes on desborland.com. The jerky's on officialgreatwhite.net, I believe it is.
Okay, I'll put those links in the show notes. So if people want to go check it out.
Yeah, it's hard to get people to, you know, I have a friend of mine who's a pinstriper and he sells all kinds of swag at car shows and he makes a living off that, you know, and he's not nationally known like the band is.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good money off selling all the swag. I go, how do you do that? He goes, well, nobody's just going to go to your website if you put an ad saying, go to my website.
Yeah.
You just got to take one item and make a little 30-second clip of it, drinking it or eating it or wearing it or panning by it, and if people like it, then they'll go, oh wow, where can you get that? And then they'll go to your site, and that's how he gets a lot of people. He sells a lot of stuff.
He makes a video clip.
Yeah, he gave me a couple of apps. It's like, anyway, he just need that 30-second clip. You don't want to go too long because people like to sit there and watch a big long, you know, commercial. But you make a real quick clip, you know. And I'm thinking about, like, I can show my coffee brewing, you know, or you can do that too, and like, you know, you grab your cup and you know, and the music plays and it just goes away. And then you have your website or whatever, you know, stuff like that, you know, different things.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have beef jerky in one hand, coffee in the other.
That'd be
yeah. Yeah, dip it in your coffee.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I'll just try different things. It's fun to do, but like I said, if you find something that sticks, I'll, you know, promote that and just go heavy with that. I mean, I have a company that would like to do wine, but a lot of people have wine, but I don't know how, you know, shipping that might be kind of hard. And that would cost a lot of money to ship a bottle of wine too, I'm sure.
Oh man. Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So. But,
all right, Audie. Well, man, it's been great talking to you, dude.
Very nice to talk to you.
Yeah. All right. Well, don't go anywhere. Okay. I got to ask you another question, but again, sure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.